Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This morning, the United States Senate stands one roll call vote away from political history, the first significant social policy in more than 20 years, the first real health reform in nearly 50.
We stand a few short steps from the most significant finish line we've had in Congress for many decades.
In all likelihood, Barack Obama's health reform passes the Senate today with only one more round of talks with the House left before it becomes law. But it is not the last we'll be hearing of health reform.
Republicans will run against it in 2010 and 2012, and they'll win back the House and the Senate and the presidency so that by 2012 they'll have enough power to get rid of it altogether.
We've got the policy, we've got the politics, and the prognostications. Health reform shapes 2008, 2010, and beyond on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 24th, Christmas Eve. I'm Todd Zwilligan for John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, Todd. And we will see, you know, it's going to be interesting of all the predictions that are made about healthcare, which ones come true and which ones do not. But let's get right to the top stories this morning. As we've been talking about, in about an hour from now, the Senate will vote on and most likely pass a health care bill. Speaking on NPR yesterday, President Obama called it a historic moment.
This will help millions of people and end up being the most significant piece of domestic legislation, at least since Medicare and maybe since Social Security.
The bill stops insurance companies from denying benefits because of pre-existing conditions and extends insurance to nearly 30 million Americans who don't have it. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid pulled together the 60 votes needed to beat back a Republican filibuster and only needs a simple majority next hour.
We stand on the doorstep of history. We recognize that. But much more importantly, we stand so close to making so many individual lives better.
No Republicans are expected to vote for the bill.
Let's go live now to the nation's capital. We're joined by Mary Agnes Carey, the senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, who is standing outside the Capitol building in the cold. Good morning, Mary Agnes.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So we're really close to a Senate bill, an hour away. I want to know who's going to want to take credit for this, the massive expansion in insurance and a crackdown on insurance companies through regulation. Who's going to want to take credit for this? Who's going to want to stay away from the obligatory press conference afterward?
Of course, you'll have Harry Reid, the majority leader, who I heard earlier in your intro. He will very much want to take credit for this. Chris Dodd, a Democrat from Connecticut, Tom Harkin of Iowa, Max Baucus of Montana, who heads the Senate Finance Committee, and Senator Harkin heads the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Key Democrats will definitely want to take credit for this. They think this is a good bill. They think it will help them in the 2010 elections and help them in the presidential elections, who may not be there from the Democratic side. People like Blanche Lincoln, a moderate Democrat of Arkansas, facing some trouble in her re-election. She's expected to vote for the bill, but whether or not she'll want to come to the mics and take credit for it, I just don't think that'll happen. But you'll have plenty of Democrats there to stand up and say this is a great bill for America.
So, Mary Agnes Carey, what's not in this bill, or what is not in this bill, the public option, it is in the House. What the Senate passes today, pretty likely to become law, or are we likely to see any changes before the president actually signs something?
There are a lot of Senate Democrats, like Ben Nelson, for example, a moderate Democrat from Nebraska, who said the bill really can't change too much from the Senate bill. Kent Conrad, head of the Budget Committee on the Senate side, has said the same thing. But the House will want to exercise its prerogative, and you have a lot of House Democrats that feel the public option is absolutely critical to this bill. So I think that question is still open for discussion.
All right. Conference between the House and the Senate, negotiations to continue. Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. Thanks for joining us.
Asian markets finished higher, and Wall Street futures are up as well. The Dow will start at 10,466. The S&P opens at 1,120, and the NASDAQ at 2,269. If you've ever been frustrated by rising cable bills, we have a story for you about how one New York Times writer broke his cable addiction and still gets all of his TV. We'll talk about that later. Also, we're remixing holiday music. We're asking you all week long, is there a holiday tune you have to hear? During the Christmas time, let us know, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. More about the healthcare bill coming up.
Good Good morning. It's Todd Zwillick here, filling in for John Hockenberry, and I'm here with Celeste, of course. It's hours before the Christmas deadline set by Senate Democrats to pass their health care bill. A vote is expected to take place by 7, starting at 7 Eastern time this morning. And though Democrats are confident they will get the simple majority, 51 votes, to push this bill through, there's still a lot of people on both sides in their own group and among Republicans who don't like the bill. But we can also start to talk about what the policy is going to look like, because things are finally moving into shape and we're starting to get an idea of what's going to be in this bill. Mary Agnes Carey is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's back with us now, standing outside, I believe, still right on Capitol Hill. Hi, Mary Agnes.
Hi there.
So, Mary Agnes, now that the Senate is finally getting this bill out the door, we can finally ask and put a point on it. We should have a pretty good idea now. I want to ask you, a family of four, okay, that makes $60,000 but doesn't have health insurance at work, what do they get, and do they get it as soon as the president signs the bill?
Well, it will depend. Let's say, I think you said they don't have insurance. There'll be a high reinsurance pool, a pool for high-risk folks, people that can't get health insurance. They might be able to benefit immediately from that. Starting in 2014 in the Senate bill, 2013 in the House bill, that family would qualify for a subsidy from the federal government that they could use to help purchase insurance. Both bills would have health insurance exchanges. They're run a bit differently. In the Senate, they'd be done on a state-by-state basis. In the House, you'd have a national exchange. But both view the exchange as a way for people to be able to shop for health insurance. Right now, let's say this family would have to buy in the individual market. You're not buying, you know, your employer's not buying on your behalf. It's tough to get insurance, especially if you've had a medical condition. It's expensive. And the hope is that this bill is targeted just towards a family like that to help them be able to get coverage if they haven't had it so far.
Okay, that family qualifies for subsidies and they get access to an exchange that's supposed to make insurance easier to shop for and hopefully will make it cheaper. Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back to you later in the program this morning. You know, this final legislation in the Senate has been, you know, Democrats have 60 votes, but this legislation has been shaped by the threat of a filibuster and holding up this bill for weeks and months. Julian Zelizer is a congressional historian and author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He joins us now. And we're also joined by Alan Simpson, former Republican senator from Wyoming. He was the Senate Republican whip from 1985 to 1995. They're both here to talk about the history and the use of the filibuster. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
You bet.
Julian, let me start with you. The most famous filibuster stories go back to trying to pass the Civil Rights Act. Most people don't know that the House was passing civil rights legislation since the 30s, and it wasn't until the late 50s that it finally passed the Senate because of the filibuster.
That's true. The filibuster was the great enemy of civil rights proponents in the 1940s and 1950s. As the bill finally got out of the House, the Southern caucus in the Senate was able to use this rule. At the time, it required 67 votes to end a filibuster to block any progress until both 1957 and then 64 when legislation passed. But the NAACP regularly listed filibuster reform as important as ending lynching or ending public segregation.
But Julian, help me out here. The majority always wants filibuster reform, right? Because they see the minority holding up all their bills.
Absolutely. I mean, the majority is often frustrated with the way that the Senate works, and you see the parties kind of flip back and forth on these positions, and I think that often makes this reform harder to achieve. I mean, you could look at the newspaper in 2004 and 2005 and find all kinds of speeches by Democrats defending the filibuster, the same ones who today are calling for some kind of reform.
Senator Simpson, why filibusters so much more common now than they were 50 years ago? I mean, even routine legislation now requires 60 votes often with the attendant delaying tactics. Why so much more common now?
Well, I think just because of the numbers. When you get near 60, I mean, you're near the magic. You're into the magic kingdom. And I think that's why it is. But Julian is quite correct. It was the Western and Southern senators that resisted the civil rights bill on the basis of an intrusion into personal rights, business endeavors, and so on. But the filibuster is like a giant wheel, like a Rube Goldberg wheel with boots on it, and it'll kick you in the fanny one time, and then as it rotates, it'll kick the other guy in the fanny. And it is a great protector. It's frustrating. It drove us crazy when I was the assistant to Bob Dole for 10 years. But let me tell you, I doubt that they'll ever get rid of it. But remember, there's always a centrist group There was that 7 and 7 group, 7 Republicans, 7 Democrats.
That's that Gang of 14.
Destroyed the nuclear option. You don't want to ever get to that, but there are centrists, and they'll surface again in the health care bill when this baby comes back from conference. It'll look like the tar baby.
Now, that 7 and 7 you're talking about, Senator Simpson, was around the issue of filibustering judicial nominations, but you piqued my interest. Give me one example, if you would, from when you were Republican whip of when the use of the filibuster kicked your fanny.
Well, it just happens. You're in the majority one session, and then you're in the minority the next. And so you just put the boot on a different foot, and you say, now, we need you guys to hold tough. And the purpose of it is cloture, which is to cut off debate. And you have to have the horses to do that. And if you don't, you don't cut off debate. But it does. I know it's frustrating. It just drove us crazy. But nevertheless, it can be the best thing in your arsenal of legislation, or it can be the worst on the other side, and that's the way it works.
It drove you crazy, but you also successfully drove your colleagues crazy when you filibustered during the debate over campaign finance reform. And I'm wondering, Julian, you know, Robert Byrd very famously filibustered for 14 hours during the debate over civil rights. Julian, As Todd was saying, when people are in the majority, they don't like filibustering. When they're in the minority, they don't. But filibustering isn't necessarily a bad thing. There have been times when it's been used to good effect.
Well, look, obviously there are some who defend the filibuster on both sides of the aisle. During the 1930s, Huey Long would use this to filibuster bills that he thought were favorable to the wealthy rather than to the poor. I think the question that gets raised with the current situation is that the filibuster is now used too much, meaning we now have an expectation that every bill in the Senate requires 60 votes. It's become the norm when that's not in the rules of the Senate. And, you know, for much of the 40s and 50s, much of the legislation still passed through a simple majority. And I think that's what you're hearing in terms of reform. Can we get this so we don't eliminate the filibuster, but that's not how the Senate operates all the time? Filibusters have increased in frequency since the 1960s, and they're used much more regularly.
So, Julian, you'd pare them back instead of – it used to be 67 until 1975. Now it's 60 votes. You'd pare it back to maybe 55 in the spirit – you know, the whole point of 60 votes is you have to form some level of consensus. In this case, the Democrats, the majority, can't just roll over the minority.
I don't have a number in mind, and I'm just talking about the reformers. But one idea, lower the number needed to end the filibuster. Another could be more change in norms, that there's some kind of agreement not to use this all the time and to save it for more extraordinary moments.
Senator Simpson, 55 votes for a filibuster. Quickly, what do you think?
No, I don't think it'll ever go to that, because you have power in one person. Look at Sanders and Lieberman and Nelson. They're playing big dog, and they've got the horses. But filibuster is the savior and demon all rolled into one glorious legislative protective shield.
Senator Alan Simpson, former senator from Wyoming and Senate Republican whip for 10 years. Julian Zelizer, congressional historian and author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terror. Thank you both for joining us. And now here's a look at the headlines we're following this morning.
Parts of Kansas, North Dakota, and Minnesota are under blizzard warnings this morning as a major winter storm hits the nation's midsection. Nearly 100 flights from Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport have been canceled. The National Weather Service is warning of hazardous driving conditions as well. Public pension programs could be in trouble. A report released by the Government Accountability Office says state and local governments need more than $500 billion to fund their public pension plans. And Citigroup executives will not have next year's bonuses cut by the Obama administration. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, what do you get for the show that has everything? Listeners calling with their favorite holiday songs. We can't get enough of it.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.